Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampir, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. My name is Jajim, and I'm here with my two co-hosts,
Jorn
and Juvon.
And today, we are taking a look at Time Trap, Star Trek Original Series book number 40 by David Dvorkin, and it was published in June of 1988. John, you want to give us an introduction to this book?
Well, it's not mentioned in the beginning of the book, and I really wish these Star Trek books, I think they did later on in later editions, but in these early editions, they didn't really place where this story was taking place. But it seemed, based on the events that occur in the book and the characters that are named in the book, the events are going to take place between 2278 and 2285 AD. To put that in something you might understand, that's between Star Trek the Motion Picture and Star Trek the Wrath of Khan. We see this because Spock refers to Kirk a few times throughout the book as Admiral when he's not being Captain. We see Kirk reminiscing about the desk job that he had and about comments that he's made to McCoy about dying in the captain's chair at some point. We also do not have Admiral Kirk having his all-consuming hatred of the Klingons that he will have after when his son is killed. And finally, Chekhov is not mentioned in the book anywhere. At this time, if I'm correct in this assumption, he is the XO of the Reliant, waiting for the events of Wrath of Khan to take place. There are a few Klingon words used in this book. They appear to be more from Mark Okrand's Klingon dictionary, making them Klingon whole, rather than the Klingonese that we talked about in the earlier books that we reviewed by John Ford that came out before and at the time that the Klingon dictionary was being put together. But still we see that the Klingon homeworld in this book is known as Klinsha and not Kronos yet. And now I'll turn it back over to Jim for summary plot.
Well, I was gonna ask you, wasn't there also a reference to the glasses that McCoy gave Kirk in this?
Yes.
That and the headaches that he's getting by not using them.
So, yeah, that I think that places it quite well.
Except that he got the glasses from McCoy in the search for Spock, which implies that he was wearing a different pair of glasses before the Benjamin Franklin glasses that he got from McCoy in the search for Spock.
Okay, well, I guess that's what you get when you're allergic to retinites. So at any rate, to summarize the plot, we have the Enterprise picks up a distress call from a Klingon ship trapped in a storm near Tholian space. Curious about their presence, Kirk beams over with a security team intending to take the Klingon captain back with him using an emergency transponder. However, the ship disappears before they can be retrieved. Kirk recovers to find himself at a Klingon base 100 years in the future. The base commander, Morath, explains that humans and Klingons are now allies. Kirk begins to accept his situation and form a relationship with a Klingon scholar named Kal Rind. The Klingons explain the Great Peace began when a Klingon peace mission was stopped by a Federation fleet, only to have Kirk appear aboard the Klingon flagship and convince Starfleet of their good intentions. Morath intends to take a group of ancient Klingon ships back in time to fulfill this part of history. Well, there it is. about overall impressions of this book? Juvon, let's start with you.
I really like this book. Of the four that we've reviewed so far, it's definitely on what I consider the better end. To me, we kind of had the first two books were on the polar opposite side. Now these last two books have, but to me, been example of good Star Trek books. However, my main issue with this entire story is I don't really feel like this is a plot the Klingons would look into. I feel like this is more of a Romulan plot. But excluding that, I really enjoyed this book.
Well, taking what you just said into consideration, it's kind of a plot they were toying with in Discovery towards the end, where they were taking the Klingons and making them into humans to infiltrate into Federation hierarchy.
And your overall impressions of this, Jorn?
I'll probably be going into it a bit later, but this book moved. This book had a lot of tropes that I've seen before, probably jaded me to it. And it was written in an era where the Star Trek books tended to be tell, not show. So a lot of the action is told to us rather than shown to us. Spock is said to not be able to relate to the crew after Kirk disappears as they're going back to Starbase 17. But we're not shown how he doesn't relate to the crew. We're not shown how he interacts with the crew and fails to connect on that human level. That's just an example.
Okay. Well, of the books we've reviewed so far, this one has been my favorite, and I really wound up enjoying it after being a little bit apprehensive at the beginning, because when they first arrived at that base, the Klingons were not very Klingon-like at all. It seemed more like they were Klingons with butterfly nets. You know, everybody was very friendly and very nice and very outgoing, and they laid on the grass in the sun and had nice little discussions and things like that, and it just seemed like the Klingons had lost all of their aggression. I read it, and I'm sitting there saying, oh boy, I don't know how I'm going to handle this. But as the book went on, of course, and things were revealed, I really, really enjoyed it.
To the author's credit, he did wrap up all of those problems that he gave the reader at the beginning and explained them.
Oh, yeah. He did a very good job of that. And I kind of knew what direction the story was going, but not until after the author did the big reveal. So, well, we'll move on to characters. Jorn, lead us through this one.
Well, to begin with, we've got the usual suspects, excluding Chekhov, but we've got a Ginny Crandall added to the Enterprise mix. And it does seem like Ginny Crandall is taken over for Chekhov. Well, he's probably moved over to the Reliant. She's now the weapons officer and the one that kind of takes a glomming onto the human advisor they bring along that Spock picks up, Elliot Tyndall, who is more than he seems as the story goes on. We find out that he's one of the Klingons that have been placed on Earth under such deep cover that they do not even know that they are Klingons and cannot accept what is happening to them as they begin to revert back at the end of the book. We also have the Klingon in charge of the Great Peace Fleet, as we can call it, Morath, and his subordinate, Kalrind, who is working with Kirk to ensure that he will fulfill the role that they have ordained him to fill to make the Great Peace happen, or really to get the Klingon fleet into Earth orbit to do their thing. We've got an old-style Klingon here in Captain Kareth and the crew of the IKS Mauler, and we've got a fake Organian that is being projected by Morath in case he needed it. The fact that they capture Captain Kirk, let alone the fact that they've captured an actual captain, Spock later reprimands Kirk for actually going on the mission where he gets caught. So the Klingons get a really big benefit of getting A, a captain, and B, Captain Kirk himself, to try and explain to the fleet, the Starfleet fleet, that the Klingons come in peace.
You know, the regular characters, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Scotty, Uhura, and so forth, they all pretty well behave as they normally do, with the exception of Kirk, who is being duped and kind of gets sucked into that. What do you think?
Also drugged.
Yeah, drugged. Duped and drugged, yes. And Juvon, what do you think of Kirk's performance in this book?
I really enjoyed the way that the writer portrayed Kirk in this one. Him being drugged out was interesting because right from the beginning, there are hints that something is amiss and something's wrong. And as you go along, he's putting the hints together with the readers to go along and not just flat out missing them. As he sees them, he picks up on them, which probably helped him picking them up a little bit faster. His betrayal was pretty spot on. My only issue with the only betrayal that I thought was kind of lackluster was the Organian. But now that I've had a week to think about this again, I think what it comes down to is this whole mission really fell apart because the only person who would know what the Organian would have acted like is Kirk. So the fact that they caught Kirk, the one person who probably would be, the one person who knows how the Organian would have acted, is the reason, kind of the reason why it all started unraveling for them, because that's when he started to suspect something was up.
Which, if you take that analysis, Juvon, a step further, Moroth, who was controlling the Organian, knew that Kirk had met this particular Organian. So why did he even introduce that bag of tricks?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, Aelborn was the leader of the Organian Council at the time, and he wasn't really himself. But then again, Kor was the Klingon commander, and probably Moroth didn't really know exactly what he needed to know in order to do this correctly.
Yeah, I get the impression, like I said, in the hindsight of our last discussion about it, is that Mormoth probably introduced the Organian, saw Kirk wasn't really buying into it, and that's why it was dropped. But because things were already put into place for the Organian ruse, that's why Kirk eventually was able to figure it all out. It's just after they saw how much Kirk wasn't buying it, they're like, we got to drop this. They're not buying it.
One of the characters that really intrigued me was Elliot Tyndall. This guy, he was not behaving very well, and I couldn't decide exactly what was going wrong with him, because as time went on, he became more and more aggravated, I should say. And then all of a sudden, it occurred to me that, wow, this guy may be mentally ill, and he became a little scary at that point.
That was definitely one thing that I didn't quite put together up until the last second. That once he started wanting to get off the ship, I was like, oh, he's a Klingon. But up until that point, I thought he was going to be more of like a plot convenience to propel the story forward. He would do something weird, and then the Enterprise would do something that sets off a chain reaction of events that saves the day. But when finally it was his storyline or his reveal happened, I was like, then you realized what was going on and Spock had put it all together. My only gripe about that particular storyline is that could have been a series of books, them rooting out all the spies, but it's kind of a background thing on this peace talks thing. Been interesting if this was at least a two-parter, where the second book they go into having to root out all the spies and the witch hunt that would ensue after that.
What's interesting is that, like you said, they could have used another book to start rooting the spies out. But the technique that Spock used to find out who all of the actual Klingons on Earth were was almost the same technique that Sisko uses in Homefront to identify all of the people that the Admiral, who's trying to usurp authority on Earth, has put in place. So,
yeah, that's a good point. I forgot that happened in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how Tyndall was not at all suffering from a mental illness. He was reverting, because of the lack of the drug, he was reverting back to his Klingon self. And on top of that, probably suffering from some withdrawal symptoms too, which made him even more aggressive than he normally would have been.
They did say at the end, when they were interrogating Kalrind, that she was more aggressive than the normal Klingon because of the drugs she was coming off of.
What were you guys' impressions of Kalrind? Do you think she actually had feelings for Kirk? Because they had been sparking together for quite some time, and when she finally came off the drugs, she was very angry at what she had done. She obviously didn't want to do what she had done, but then again, at the end of the book, she seemed to still care for him.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that. I would hazard to say, yeah, she probably still has feelings for him, but it could also be that she's too confused about what's going on because she'd been under the influence of that drug, and she's probably aware of how she felt on the drug, so she might be just not sure how to feel about him collapsing.
And not knowing what the drug actually did on a biochemical level, I mean, how far did the drug go to become a love potion?
Yeah, well, the author did a masterful job making her the way she was, because it did a great job of masking what was actually going on, and actually a little bit of misdirection involved there too.
Did anybody notice that Elliot's wife substituted his pills based on a recommendation of a neighbor who did a similar thing for her husband?
I remember that.
That was definitely convenient for the storyline, but it's also funny at the same time. Just the whole that the only reason he was acting the way it was is because the drug was wearing off, and then she just took the drugs completely away from him.
But she did it because a neighbor suggested it, because the neighbor had done it for her husband, hinting at more people like Elliot on Earth.
Aha, that I hadn't thought of, but that is a really good point. Of course, we have, the Klingon agent that was in trouble with Tribbles. And so apparently there are Klingon agents all over the place.
He's even mentioned in this book.
Yes, he is. And then, they seem to be at very high levels.
That was what they were indicating. And that episode of DS9 that I was referring to, Homefront, had the same issue, in that it was changelings that were at very high level of the Federation.
Yeah, the changelings had a bit of a disadvantage, the changelings had an advantage because they didn't require medication in order to infiltrate. All they had to do was shapeshift.
They didn't have to destroy huge swaths of the Earth surface to give their agents the cover story they needed to actually blend into society either.
Yeah, those episodes of Deep Space Nine where they dealt with that. That was pretty scary.
I mean, in this book, in Time Trap, we had to have things like, the Devlin Hole and a few other things where entire cities, entire towns were wiped out with their records gone, so that you could put somebody in and nobody would know he's not the person that he's claiming to be.
Yeah, the Klingons seemed to be a lot more crafty at this. And again, that harkens back to what Juvon said earlier, that it seems like the Klingons were more like Romulans in this book than they were Klingons.
Well, let's not forget a private little war where the Klingons are deciding to take over a planet by slowly arming one side of two tribes that exist on the planet, and doing so by gradually improving the technology for their side.
Oh yeah, that's right. Trying to make it look like they are developing in a logical sort of way, but they were the ones influencing it.
I do wonder what Klingons, if the Klingons off this plot with what little we know about the Organian Accords or treaty. Like, when they got to Earth, could they even really have done anything? I know they, it was, it, I think Spock speculated some of the ships were going to do suicide runs and just crash right into the planet. But would they have really been able to do anything before the Organians just stepped in and wiped out the Klingon fleet?
If you're trying to destroy an entire planet, not conquer it, just destroy it, all you got to do is play pinball. Knock a few asteroids into the planet.
Juvon, you're once in a while, your connection seems to be breaking up a little bit. Missed just the very first part of what you had said there. So,
oh, I was just wondering what the Organians, or I was wondering what the Klingons, how the Klingons thought they could get away with this because of the Organian treaties that, I know some of the Klingon ships were set for suicide runs, or they speculated they were, but even like the asteroid thing, would the Klingons still be able to get away with that? Like, shouldn't the Organians be stepping in? Like, the whole Organian thing was just kind of, I really wish there was a book that just settled why the Klingons and the Federation could fight again, because it's not really clear how much sway the Organians have over them based on one book to the next.
My thought on that would be that the Organian treaty was superseded by perhaps the Khitomer Accords.
But without the Organians being at Khitomer during the negotiations, they could easily just ignore the Khitomer Accords and keep doing their treaty. But they did predict that the Federation and the Klingons would be allies, and they may have seen the Khitomer Accords as the fulfillment of that prediction, and then just, you know, went away to do their own thing, like most of the Q continuum does.
Apparently there's a book or a comic that does cover how the Organian, why the Organians aren't around, but if I understand, it makes Kirk look like a bit of a dick.
Interesting way to put it. Well, we have started talking about Organians, and we have the fake Aelborn here. As you mentioned before, John, he doesn't behave the way one would expect.
But that's because of the man behind the curtain.
And yes, that's Morath who is running Aelborn, who apparently he doesn't know a great deal about that.
Probably just what he's read from Kor's report about the incident on Organia.
You know, it was all part of the ruse to convince Kirk of what was going on, I'm sure.
Since Kor isn't in the story, I do wonder how official Morvus' plan is, or if he's kind of taking his fleet and he's doing his own thing. Because you think if the High Council was backing, you think they would send Kor to help out with the Organian part.
I don't think Morath has the blessing of the High Council in this at all.
He did get a lot of ships then for not having the blessing.
Wouldn't the ships then be controlled by his house?
Yeah, he could have been a fleet admiral. We didn't really know who he was beyond what he told Kirk.
And we have to assume that what he told Kirk was a lie.
Exactly.
Of course, the High Council could have given the blessing and also reserved the right of plausible deniability. So, you know, if you're successful, great. We're going to shower you with glory. If you don't do this, you are in big trouble.
I seem to feel there was an explanation like that in one of the books we read. I can't remember if it was this one or one of the other ones.
I don't remember it in this one, but
I have noticed that in the early books, which of course are not canon, there are inconsistencies that come up from time to time.
Do you think the inconsistencies in this novel, like, I know the books just aren't canon in general, but let's say the book's in canon until something in the series contradicts it. Would this book still be in canon, or has there been an episode that contradicted it?
That's a good question. From what I know of what happens now with the publishing of books, the last several years, 20 years, as a matter of fact, the authors communicate with each other as they're writing the book, and they follow each other, and there is a person at Simon & Schuster who makes sure that everything in the books are consistent with each other. So in other words, if you have a character killed off in an earlier book, they don't magically appear in another book. The character has to stay dead as time goes on. Perhaps the continuity errors that appear in the early books are because that the authors did not communicate with each other, and they didn't have a central place to compile the information so that there would be consistency throughout the novels.
That makes sense.
So it'd be more like fan fiction than a series of books.
In fact, a lot of the early books that they published literally were fan fiction.
Oh, yeah.
I have some called, I think they're called Trek logs or something like that. And they
Star Trek logs. I believe those are the Alan Dean Foster novelization of the animated series.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Thanks.
But there's another series of books that a pair of fan editors of Star Trek fanzines convinced the publisher at the time to put out, and I think they're called New Voyages or something along that lines. There's at least two volumes of them.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah, that was they used to have an ad in the back of all their novels saying that you could submit fanfic to them.
Well, that would explain a great deal then.
I remember the rules. Basically, the general rule is that everything had to be the same. Everything had to be back to the status quo of the series at the end of each episode, at the end of your story, was the loose rule about it.
Well, probably, and also making sure to follow Roddenberry's guidelines for what is and is not acceptable in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I think those came out, I remember one coming out in the 90s, because at first I was like, wait, 100 stories in one book? That's a great deal. And I started reading the back. I was like, oh, this is just fan fiction.
And I think they came out more in the 70s, actually, because they were back there at the time when the only real new Star Trek book we had out was Spock Must Die.
That's the first one, right?
James Blish was doing the Star Trek novelizations of the TV episodes. And when he got done, he wrote a book, Spock Must Die. So, yeah, that's pretty much the first one.
I remember reading that a long time ago.
We should review that at one point.
Yeah, probably wouldn't hurt. That would probably be the first original Star Trek novel, do you think?
Yes, it was.
Well, then we definitely owe that one a look. I mean, I can't even tell you how long ago it was I read that, but I know it was very many years ago.
Yeah, I believe it's one of the books that I got from the Science Fiction Book Club back when I was joining the thing when I was still in college.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the places and things that we saw in this book. I'll tell you what, this new Klingon colony, new Klingon base they had was kind of interesting. Green grass, nice buildings, all kinds of wonderful things going on, and Klingon guards in certain areas to make sure that Kirk didn't go into it. It seemed like a bit of a contradiction going on.
And Kirk noticed the contradiction into the fact that the warning placards were both in Federation and Klingon.
Yeah, and they popped up after he tried to go into a place he wasn't allowed. So it's clearly just for him.
They tried to explain it away in the course of the book, but the explanation kind of seemed weak. But I think the author wanted the explanation to be weak, so it kept questioning whether or not what was going on was real.
Well, they also had Kirk on drugs, so he may have been, because of that, ignoring his own little suspicions that would naturally come up as he went around to these places.
Depending on the drugs, that grass may not have been green.
Very true.
He just associated what he expected a nice planet to be like.
I'll tell you what, those had to be some amazing drugs.
To get an aggressive Klingon to be a mild-mannered person willing to not bring attention to themselves, those have to be strong drugs too. Apparently they had a very good pharmaceutical industry.
I think that's weird that they have a good pharmaceutical industry, but they can't figure out how to do surgery.
Well, if we look at some of the later books, especially Keith Chancio's, he talks about the state of Klingon medicine. And it's really not important to the Klingons to patch people up as effectively as it is to in the Federation to patch people up.
Yeah, they talked about that too in Enterprise during the Klingon augment storyline.
In Keith's books, he follows a character that was introduced in Next Generation, Clegg, who had had his arm actually amputated and replaced with the arm of Clegg's father.
But he, for the first couple of books, Clegg did not have that arm, did not get it replaced because he was being offered a mechanical arm, and that would have been dishonorable to him. He accepted his father's arm to try and bring honor back to his father when he accepted his father for what he was.
And the funny thing is, too, is that the surgeon, the Klingon surgeon that did that, was trained at Starfleet Medical.
I'm sorry, what are these the IKS Gorkon books?
Yes. I think we're drifting, Jim. Yeah, those are the Gorkons.
Yeah.
If you said it, I just didn't catch it.
No, I didn't mention that.
We just drifted off, and I was thinking to myself, wow, we're off topic. If we want to review that book, let's review that book. But let's not talk about it now, because we're supposed to be talking about Time Trap.
Oh, we can reference other works, too. We're back in Tholian space for a bit of this book, which is apparently making a ship disappearing look a little like time travel.
It's interesting that they had this idea now, considering what we know what happens to the USS Defiant later. I'd be surprised if the people behind writing the Mirror Universe Enterprise episodes know anything about this book. And obviously, because it's a hoax, the whole time travel thing negates itself. But I think it's just it's interesting in hindsight that there is a precedence for time travel in this area, in this part of space, and the dimensional hopping that this writer wouldn't have been aware of at the time. And I would be curious to know if this book did influence the people who came up with the dark the Mirror Universe storyline.
In fact, I would have to go back and watch the last few episodes of Discovery, but I think the Discovery itself was lost in Tholian space on the mirror side of the universe.
Oh, it might have been. Yeah, I'd have to go back and see that. The one that I picked up quickly was they're talking about the Defiant, which links them to Enterprise, which linked Enterprise to TOS.
So anyway, didn't they establish in Enterprise that when the Defiant did finally wink out of existence in this universe, it did indeed go to the Mirror Universe?
Yeah, and back in time, 100 years or so.
Right, so we don't establish that in original series, so they don't actually know where the Defiant went at that point. And then, of course, that would mean when the Klingon ship disappeared, they wouldn't have known where it had gone.
No, I just find an interesting coincidence.
They were assuming that it just got moved to another dimension, another universe.
Yeah, it's a kind of an interesting thing to how well things kind of came full circle. So we did find out where things are. They left it open enough so that the loose ends could be tied up by Enterprise.
And here's the even crazier part that makes the whole time travel thing plausible. Now that Discovery has established that Starfleet now knows what happened to the USS Defiant before it even disappears, it means that the Klingons could have found out about it, and that could I know that Discovery never happened when the guy wrote it, but you could almost argue that the Klingons could have found out about that during the infiltration. That's why they chose the jump in the future as their master plan.
Yeah, it's pretty well thought out. So, what do you guys think about the new Klingon Empire? If it had actually been that way, what were your impressions of that?
You mean the United Federation of Klingons?
Well, I like to call them Klingons with butterfly nets.
But it seemed like that's what Morath was trying to emulate when he was coming up with this, with his new Klingons, in that they were going to be just like the Federation, so well allied with the Federation that it would be two peas in the same pod type of races.
Knowing Klingons the way we do, do you think that would ever be possible?
No.
Klingons use the Roman tactic for assimilating cultures. Go in, conquer, and make them part of their empire. So that would be the way it would happen, not the Federation way, which would be go in, negotiate, show what they can offer, show what the new planet has to offer, and become equal partners.
So then, in light of your Roman analogy to Klingons, the downfall of the Roman Empire, at least as far as I was taught in school, was because they would outreach their resources. In other words, they didn't develop the resources that they had available. They would just conquer and take on new resources. Do you think that the Klingon Empire will fall eventually for the same reason?
I hate to bring it back up again, but in the series of books on the IKS Gorkon, that is exactly what they're worried about.
I've seen it mentioned in other novels too. They're slipping my mind now. I've read so many of them lately that they discuss that to survive they need to expand, and I think that might have even been in a movie too.
I think Galron mentions it once or twice during his tenure on Next Gen and DS9.
That might be where I'm thinking of.
I'm trying to think of the planet that blew up in the movie.
Praxis?
Praxis. So we do get an example of how resources are being used when Praxis blows up. And yeah, there's a lot of references in the movies, in that movie, to Klingon resources.
The fact that, what was it, all of their power was coming from this particular moon?
Yeah, that was their entire base for creating power, and they were going to go away if they couldn't get that fixed up, which is how Spock got Kirk involved in all of that.
And it got the Klingons talking.
Well, perhaps we should move on to you. John, in your notes, you have a list of clues. Tell us what that's about.
In any mystery, in any novel that is making it so that you're trying to solve a puzzle, as in this one, the author leaves clues throughout the book so that if you're really, 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 really good at mysteries, you solve it before you get to the end. If the author's really, 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 really good, when the author does his reveal, you do a palm face and say, God, I should have seen that. He left all these clues for me. That's what clues are all about.
And what were some of the clues that you picked up in this?
In the very beginning, when we're first introduced to Elliot, the question came to my mind, is he actively sabotaging this weapons project that he declares a failure and basically orders the technician who is working on it, who is designing it, to move on to do something else?
It's an interesting thought. I hadn't given that much thought.
Is Tyndall thinks about sabotaging Spock's project at one point, but decides that it would be better for him to go with Spock back to the Enterprise. I mentioned earlier the neighbor taking the same vitamins as Elliot. What was this Devon ditch or other disasters that we have? We find out at the end what they're for, why they exist, but they're dropped throughout the book as breadcrumbs for people to pick up.
See, I completely missed that.
It really bothered me when you had this major disaster that is prevalent at the beginning of the book. They go back to it and they reminisce about Elliot's childhood down in that ditch. And then when they meet somebody who was also from that community, he runs away from him.
See, I kind of eluded me, the ditch thing and everything. I couldn't fit that into the rest of the story. Did you find that the same way, Javon?
I think I had mentioned earlier the Elliot thing. It was all a hindsight thing that I realized all the breadcrumbs were there. It wasn't till I knew something was up with him, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And I thought he was just going to go off his rocker and create a series of events that happened to save the day. It wasn't until he was trying to get onto the Klingon ship that I'm like, oh, he's a Klingon. So personally, in the hindsight, I realized where all the clues were left off, and him not wanting to talk to that guy and just saying he was a jerk. Well, if it was me, if everybody I knew died and there's one guy who was still a dick, I'd probably still take the time to walk up to him and say hi.
There are several things that start making Kirk distrust Morath that is thrown in this book, particularly, as we mentioned before, those bilingual warning signs.
Now, that, believe it or not, is one thing I at least did pick up on.
And the doctor, the Klingon doctor that's treating Kelrin, calls her Joh, which is Lord, which is saying there's some hierarchy going on, and he has to take orders from her.
Yeah, I picked up on that too. I don't know if I happen to recognize the word as a rank, or if Kirk had said something in his monologue that tipped me off to it. But yeah, I picked up that she actually had a rank and she wasn't just a historian.
Well, the way he addressed her, you also got that feeling. So it wasn't just the fact that I've got a pair of Klingon dictionaries on my desk and I can look the words up when I need to. But the way David had him talking to her gave you that impression that she was of a higher rank. Didn't matter what, but she was of a higher rank.
One clue that you mentioned earlier on that I felt was a pretty good clue was the whole first run-in with the Organian.
Care to explain?
Just the whole behavior of the Organian and how dismissive he was and just the way he acted. To me, that was a clue that something was amiss.
Like Morath didn't know how the Organian should act to somebody who knew him.
Exactly.
Well, the clues thing, that's really an interesting deal. I am not a person who enjoys mystery writing. I don't read mystery, and I'm not real good at picking up on little things like that. So I'm glad you brought that out.
It's not just mysteries. Most every book that you read has some little subterfuge hidden somewhere, some aha moment that's going to be coming your way. If you haven't dropped the breadcrumbs as an author before the reader gets to that point, you're pulling a ex deus machina out to solve the problem of your story, and it becomes a very unsatisfying ending.
A lot of murder mystery shows are like that too now, that they intentionally leave something out so you could never actually solve it yourself.
And that's particularly sloppy writing, because you should throw the clues out there, but throw a red herring or two so that you don't know which clue is actually the valid one.
My brother and I used to drive my sister nuts because we'd be like watching Murder, She Wrote, and by the end of the first act, we've guessed it, and it pisses her off because she feels like we always ruin the end of the episode for her.
Well, and then you had Columbo, who told you who did it at the beginning, and then he had to find the clues just to prove it.
Ah, he was great, Peter Falker.
Yeah, that was a good show.
It's Peter's way of doing that character that made that show interesting, because it literally was a reverse murder mystery.
What would you call it? A visual connect the dots.
And finding the dots.
Well, once they switched to doing TV movies all the time, they always got somebody to play the murder who you recognize. So there was no point in burying the lead on it. Like, William Shatner's the only person you recognize. Of course he killed his wife.
Yeah, that's pretty bad in TV shows. When they do introduce somebody who's a known star, you'd not pretty much be the one who did it.
True. Well, let's talk a little bit about our favorite points of plot. I don't know. I like the entire book. I guess my favorite point of the plot was when the big reveal came, when the Klingons were actually Klingons as they are supposed to be, that they were using these drugs in order to suppress their natural aggression, how well those drugs had worked, and that they were also using them on Kirk to pull him into their story and actually convince him to go along with this big ruse in spite of some of the clues that were right in front of him and didn't pique his suspicions until later.
In my case, the Kirk portions of the book were almost a distraction to me. They were good, but what was really interesting to me was Spock piecing things together and having an idea of what's going on by the time they finally got the two fleets together and they meet up with Captain Kirk again.
Yeah, picking one point of the plot is kind of hard for this one because one point couldn't really stand on its own too much because it all kind of works together. I guess the concept that they were going to go back in time for this big peace treaty, I found was an interesting plot point. I didn't believe it for a second that was actually happening, but it did engage me a lot thinking about, well, what if this is actually happening? How would they react on the other end? And that kept me preoccupied thinking about that in between reading sessions. I kept on trying to figure out how this could actually work within the confines of the continuity. The only thing I could really come up with is that the entire fleet would get massacred afterwards. But I was interested to see if it did turn out. It would have been just as interesting to find out that they were 100 years from the future and see that wrap up as it is that they weren't, that it was a ruse the entire time.
Another comment on plot points. A really good author makes it so you don't have a particular plot point that distinguishes itself from the entire novel. A problem that we're used to is, especially in second half of Next Generation, most of DS9 and almost all of Voyager, we literally have two or more stories running pretty concurrently through every episode. The really, really good episodes of DS9 get away from this concept of two of the characters are doing one thing, two of the other characters are doing another thing, and somebody else is doing something down the middle.
Yeah, A and the B plots in hour-long TV shows are pretty common.
For instance, Babylon 5 lived on that.
Yeah, there was always something else going on. There was one episode where the B plot was, I forget the security chief's name, but he was putting together a motorcycle with one of the aliens.
Garibaldi.
Yeah, Garibaldi. That was like the B plot of the episode.
But see, with Babylon 5, with all those species on the station, that makes sense. With Next Gen and DS9 and Voyager, you're either one ship or you're a federation together, and you have less opportunities to do that. My point, though, here is that it's a really good author that keeps all of these things integrated together.
Okay, did we want to talk about themes?
I think the major theme basically here is can people change? What is personality? What controls it? And how is it shaped? Is it drug-induced?
I guess aspects of the personality, I guess, can be suppressed or brought out through drug therapy. But besides, like, a few, like, exaggerated cases, for the most part, I think that people tend that the change has to come not to sound like an after school special, but it has to come from within the person themselves. It can't just be medicated away. They have to want to change for any of that to really matter.
I would agree with that to a point, but in my profession as a teacher, we see it all the time where you have a student who is having a lot of trouble focusing and concentrating or just sitting still or something like that, and they try to give the child medication to help level out that. And oftentimes what'll happen is we go from one extreme to another, where we have a kid who is overactive, very difficult to control in a classroom to one that is catatonic. And it takes a long time for those drugs to either work correctly, or it also could take a long time to find the right balance so that you don't completely destroy someone's personality while you're trying to help them gain control.
Oh, I agree with that. I see that. I've seen that tons at work. We had one guy that was completely off the wall, and it turned out that was because of the meds that he was taking were conflicting with each other.
And a lot of those meds are either discovered by chemicals that our body is producing to control our moods and our mood swings and how we look at things, or looking at what's missing in our bodies to make a particular thing happen. I mean, we've identified, you know, endorphins as being what makes us happy. So can we control moods with a little red pill? But then wasn't that a major theme in science fiction back in the 60s?
Unfortunately, too, like, it's never as simple as giving everybody the same pill. Like, if that was the case, everybody would be properly medicated. As much as it's a science, it's also a guessing game at the same time.
Right now it's a guessing game, but they're looking at using chaos theory and parameter understandings to try and figure out what the particular dosage is. If you think of every physical body, every organism as being a different biochemical laboratory needing different biochemicals to make it function properly, then you can see where research needs to go to try and achieve the goals that you're trying to achieve. It's a matter of what goals do we want to achieve? We've got the same questions with genetic engineering, especially prenatal. What characteristics do you want to pick for your child, or do you want to leave it to nature to pick those for your child? And I think we're looking at, in this book, a situation where the Klingons are trying to find drugs to force emotions and moods on their own people to achieve a certain political dynamic.
It's very difficult to do, too, because we do not fully understand how the mind works.
We do not fully understand how the biochemistry of the rest of the body works either.
Yeah, just because one thing works for somebody, that same pill will screw somebody else up because their body has a deficiency of something, or they have too much of it, so that pill doesn't work for them now because it causes something else to go out of imbalance. I do not envy the people at work who have to make these decisions.
I take it you work for Big Pharma?
No, I'm a prison guard.
Okay, let's move into closing thoughts on this book.
I really like this book. I'd probably give it a 5 out of 5. The whole general idea of it was really interesting. I found it really engaging, like playing the what-if scenario in my mind while I was reading it. The mystery was very well crafted, and I do particularly enjoy mysteries where there's so much being thrown at me at the end. I'm kind of like, oh, that's what that was going on. So the Elliot thing, to me, was a nice surprise that so much was going on that I did miss it. And yet the breadcrumb, I could still follow the breadcrumbs back to the source of it. It's interesting doing this, reviewing this book with you guys a second time, because now I've had a week of hindsight. And I feel more optimistic. Even though I was optimistic about it last time, I feel more optimistic about this book. I appreciate it even more, because some of the other discussions we had led me to realize that one of the reasons this whole thing fell apart is because Kirk had personal experience with the Organians. If they captured somebody from a different ship who didn't know the Organians that well, this plan could have gone very bad, potentially.
For the listeners who are wondering about that last comment, we recorded this particular podcast a week ago, and because of technical difficulties, the recording didn't get recorded. So we're doing it again, which means we're hoping this one's going a little bit smoother than our first attempt at this was.
Yeah, despite how many sidetracks we did this time, I think there were a lot more sidetracking last time.
Yeah. My thoughts on this book, it's a well-crafted book. It's a well-crafted mystery. My only problem with it is, aside from a few typos and wanting to go in and edit it, it does a lot of telling, not showing. And as I said before, back in the 80s, this was a style of writing that most science fiction did. Today, we do, and we stress onto new writers, you need to show your reader, not tell your reader. You need to describe the actions, not tell them that this thing happened. I'm trying to think of another example other than the Spock one that I talked about earlier. But again, like I said, overall, I'd probably give this book a 4 out of 5, and wish there was a longer book written to let me see all the character interactions that were just told about.
So you mentioned that you thought that the author should have shown instead of told. You think maybe that's because we've become such a visual society now?
If you look at books going back to the beginning of the 1900s, we had a definite three changing in style of writing. It is very hard to go back and read a Lovecraft because of the style that it was reading. An Edgar Allan Poe story was, again, a tell, not show so much story. Then we developed radio. You saw authors like Isaac Asimov, who were writing their stories very much using dialogue more than description, just like you saw on radio. Then we've gone to television, and more people watch television today than listen to radio today, or listen to audio plays on radio today. And so you're seeing more description, interaction. You still get the dialogue, but you've got a lot of telling things up to the dialogue. As you say, you're seeing more show than tell than the tell that we saw back in the early days.
See, I have to agree with you, because I remember, this was a few years ago, I downloaded the audio book for Les Miserables, and I really could not finish it because, for one, it was 36 hours long, and I was listening going back and forth to work, and I commute about an hour a day both directions, and the descriptions, you would go into a room and the author is describing details about the room. This was placed here and that does this and this is sitting over there. And it was very, very detailed in descriptions of rooms, which really today would not add much to the story. And so it almost became, for me at least, a distraction.
Your descriptions today are going to be more character-driven descriptions than the sitting room descriptions of books back then. To give listeners an idea of what he means, how thick this book is based on 36 hours, The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, any of the three books, are about a 24-hour audio book.
Yeah, and today we don't have the time, because there's so much information to take in, that we don't have time to really sit down and appreciate the level of detail that they used long ago when writing books.
When reading books was the only entertainment that you have. There was no radio. There was no TV. You got your view of other cultures fully from the books.
Yeah, I completely agree. My overall impressions were, as I said before, I really like this book. I'm going to rate it a solid 4. I'm looking forward to our next one.
Which is what, Jim?
Which is what, Juwan?
Well, just before we get into that, I do have that somebody sent in a review of this book to us from Adrian. Overall, it was a fun read. The plot was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the idea of Klingon infiltration into the Federation and the scheme to trick Kirk into playing along with their plan to send a great fleet to Earth. The characterization is also well done. He did a good job of writing the dialogue that fit personalities of the characters, especially for Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. The romance between Kirk and Cal Ridd was exactly what I expected it to be, and you would expect Kirk to have some sort of romantic interest with a Klingon or with a female during the story. But he found that I seem to have misplaced the second page, but he felt that that Kirk's inability to move past their relationship, he didn't buy into that. He thought Kirk would have been a little bit more cold-hearted to her. And then William Sturtron commented on our last thing, telling us that the board game came out a year before the Klingon game that we were talking about. And he posted a link to the Borg, Star Trek Borg, with John Delancey in it. And he was wondering what his prize would be.
Weren't we offering a no prize for that?
Yeah. He mentioned in a later comment that he got the joke.
Well, nobody goes away from here empty-handed, so we're going to cut off his hands.
Fair enough. But if you want, you could send us a recommendation. Just make sure it's on Kindle, and this is just in general. We are always looking for recommendations. We do have quite a few, but we would like recommendations from more of our listeners so that we can take a look at what everybody likes. Feel free to either comment those on the Facebook page, the keg.org page, on the individual podcasts, or send us an email to podcasts@keg.org and just let us know. I say try to make sure it's on Kindle because it's just more likely we'll review it, because then we will all have easy access to it. If it's not there, then we can't really make any guarantees. And then as well, since I'm going into where you can find us at, if you put in Keg Podcast, one word, into Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, you should be able to find us on all those. And we love to hear back from you guys. It's mostly me posting a bunch of pictures of books that I read with my animals. And as for what we're reading next time, we are moving away from Klingons, and we're going to be actually looking at Romulans, My Enemy, My Ally by Deanne Dunay. And we're going to have two guests with us next time. Is who they are a secret, or?
Kathy and Ryan Peck.
Okay, so it's not a secret. So they will be on the next time. But that being said, we're taking a bit of a hiatus until we will be recording the next one at the end of April.
Okay, and the author on that was actually Diane Duane, right?
Oh, correct. Sorry.
Well, you know where to find us. You know what we're reading next. So we're going to sign off for today. I'm Judge Jim.
I'm Jorn.
And I'm Javon.
And join us next time for Bound by Honor. Kapla.
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 You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!